Well, under hot stories at coasttocoastam.com, NASA's sharpest-eyed orbiter at Mars has spotted the Spirit rover far below, sitting on a rock formation nicknamed Home Plate. Such imagery could provide new clues about the plateau's geological history and serve as a guide for Spirit's future moves around Home Plate. It's an incredible story, and you'll see a picture on the coasttocoastam.com website under Hot Stories. Mars orbiter spots rover on weird plateau. Little tiny rover, but it's there. It's there. In a moment, we're going to be talking about the universe, the electric universe, thunderbolts in the universe on Coast to Coast AM. I'm going to introduce you to two guests tonight. David Talbot is a comparative mythologist. He has devoted 35 years to examining the origins of ancient beliefs and symbolic traditions. He is the author of The Saturn Myth and co-author with Wallace Thornhill, whom you will meet in a second here, of Thunderbolts of the Gods. His reconstruction of the ancient sky was the subject of the feature documentary Remembering the End of the World. David Talbot. Hey, David, how are you? And welcome back to Coast.
Thank you very much, George, and thanks for the invite.
Oh, I'm looking forward to this. And Wallace Thornhill is an Australian physicist. His lifelong investigation of the electric universe offers a revolutionary view of solar system history, the nature of the sun, the behavior of comets, and stellar and galactic evolution. He is the co-author with David, as I mentioned, of Thunderbolts of the Gods and also The Electric Universe. Wallace, hi.
Hi there.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good, good. David, tell me a little bit how you and Wallace got together.
Oh, that's actually quite an interesting story because I first met Wall at a conference that my organization sponsored way back in 1974. And I then didn't see him. Afterwards, well, we had shared an evening together at a banquet at the concluding event at this conference, and then I never saw him again until the mid-90s, and I had completely forgotten him. And then when we had a conference in the Portland area, I had gotten to know the work of Wall Thornhill and met him, and only later did he tell me that he was the fellow that I had sat through that evening banquet with 20 years earlier. Across from us was, very interestingly, David Morrison, who went on to become a very distinguished figure in NASA. David Morrison kind of signed up with the mainstream, and Wall and I converged from completely different vantage points. My mythological investigation and his study of the electric universe came together in the mid-90s, and we've been collaborating ever since.
Very good. You know, I spent an hour or so watching the video on the Internet of Thunderbolts of the Gods, which was, by the way, very well done and extremely informative. I'm looking forward to this discussion with both of you tonight. You know, one of the things, of course, is late October, where the amateur astronomers were simply amazed when they saw This object that was so small originally, Comet Holmes, appear in the sky, got very bright. Full moon a few days ago kind of hid it from us for a while.
Yeah.
But an incredible story. Let's start with you on this, Wallace. What do you think happened to this comet?
Well, I think, George, that what happened was that it suddenly began discharging more strongly than it had in the past. When that happens, the first thing that occurs is a glow discharge. And because it's an electrical phenomenon around a tiny central object, it forms a giant sphere. And that sphere is glowing. So the brightness of the comet suddenly went from something that no one would notice in the sky to something that you could see easily with the naked eye. It brightened, I think, over a million times from what it was before. Now, this is easily explained in electrical terms, but in terms of material being outgassed from the tiny comet nucleus, first, you wouldn't expect it to form a neat sphere around the object, and second, you wouldn't expect it to be that bright.
The electrical event that seems to surround this comet, and we'll, of course, talk about what else is out there in the universe, then that's what you think is sparking this brightness, this glow all around it?
Yes, it seems that Comet Holmes must have struck a change in the solar wind environment, in other words, the electrical environment of the sun as it moves out to, past the planets. Sometimes it takes with it regions where there is either stronger charge or more dense solar wind, or the speed of the wind changes suddenly. It's these sudden changes which can give rise to an outburst from a comet.
David, could it have hit what some are talking about as dark matter?
That's right. I've seen that suggestion. And, of course, some have suggested that it hit a rock out there, which is highly implausible in that region. The issue with dark matter is so obscure. It's really reaching to excess. The problem for our standard theories of comets is that Holmes was moving far, far from the sun. It was moving away from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
It was out past the orbit of Mars. And in fact, it spends its time between the orbits of Mars and the sun. So there was no plausible...
Mars and Jupiter, David.
Hello?
Between yeah. Mars and Jupiter.
Mars and Jupiter.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, indeed. I don't even remember now what I said, but it must have been crazy. Okay, yes, that's where it spends its time. And that comet actually exploded into light in 1892 as well. So here's a very undistinguished comet that has brightened inexplicably twice. In 1892, when it brightened so surprisingly, it was out close to Jupiter's orbit. So the model of comets, which sees them as evaporating in the warmth of the sun, has not worked for Comet Holmes, and it has not worked for many other comets as well that have mysteriously disintegrated millions of miles from the sun or exhibited enigmatic outbursts as they are out as far as Saturn's orbit from the sun.
And
so there's a great mystery there.
What are some of the comets? I mean, physicist James McCanney believes that they may not be just all icy bodies. Some could be iron and rock. As well, both of you, you David and you Wallace, what do you think a comet might be?
Well, I think it's quite well established by the whole body of evidence, George, that we are already visiting comets that are rocky bodies.
Mm-hmm.
You see them very sharply.
Like an asteroid? Similar?
They're very similar. In fact, really indistinguishable from asteroids, except that they are moving through the electric field of the sun in a way that asteroids are not.
Okay.
So we're really at a critical juncture in the history of astronomy and cosmology, because in our view now, NASA scientists are going to meet up with a rock in space that is discharging electrically in a considerable cometary display. And in that one discovery, once it becomes undeniable that it it is not an icy body, you will see a revolution in the view of the solar system, because that requires then an electric field of the sun. And if an electric field of the sun is strong enough at those distances to create a cometary display, then there is an electric field sufficient to light the sun. And that throws into doubt, then, the standard fusion model of the sun. That's
uh-huh.
like a series of dominoes, then, that reaches out to stellar formation and stellar evolution and so on.
So you're saying it may not be the sun alone that is creating this field, that the field may be in the universe.
The field is creating the sun.
Yes.
In truth, that's the electric model of the sun, and the sun is connected to galactic currents that are not visible streams of charged particles, But we are meeting up with electric fields in space everywhere we go, and the consequent magnetic fields pervade the universe. So this is the electric universe, and I am just proud to be aligned with Wal Thornhill, who has really pioneered an interdisciplinary vision of the electric universe.
Wallace, is this electric field, is it throughout the universe, or is it just in certain spots and areas?
The electric field tends to be concentrated in certain spots, and over large distances, it may be very weak. For instance, within the solar system, between the planets, the electric field is very weak. So we don't see cosmic rays striking the Earth from due to that electric field.
Okay.
But when you get very close to the sun, then you see the sort of energy that's involved in the electric field of the sun when you reach the corona, because the corona is millions of degrees in temperature, although using temperature as a measure of the energy there is actually incorrect. So, and the very fact that the comet itself was larger than the sun, that sphere that I mentioned earlier, that glowing sphere or coma, was actually larger than the sun. And this is typical of an electrical body in the universe, that it coats itself with a glowing sheath. So the actual sun, whatever it is, resides deep within that thing we call the sun. And what we're actually looking at is a huge electrical discharge.
If a spacecraft happened to hit one of these electric fields, what would happen to it, if anything?
It would depend on precisely which one it struck. If it struck one of the ones near the sun, it could be quite devastating to the electronics and so on board. And in fact, there have been occasions when spacecraft, like, for instance, the Galileo orbiter, when it was passing above Io, actually went through one of the so-called volcanic jets. Now, that is an electrical discharge. And it reset all the computers on board so that they missed getting some of the data that we would have liked. In fact, I warned beforehand that it was a very dangerous process, which may result in the spacecraft no longer functioning. But luckily, the ingenuity of the engineers was enough to allow them to recover from that.
Can you determine whether you're going into this field? I mean, do they know?
You can determine what's ahead of you to some degree by looking at the signals from radio waves emitted by the strong electric field. And this is the kind of thing that one astronomer has done recently when looking at the so-called cosmic microwave background radiation, the WMAP information, and has shown that it actually comes from a network of electric currents flowing near the solar system. So it has nothing to do with the Big Bang.
Go ahead,
David. I think this whole question of electric fields in space needs to consider the weakness of the electric field as you would measure it across a short distance. And that's all that a probe could measure. So if you're just moving in deep space, well, let's just say between planets, for example.
Okay.
The electric field of the sun at any point, let's just say across a few meters, is so weak as to be immeasurable. But what you have to consider is the incredible volume across a billion miles of space and more. And when a comet is rushing in toward the sun at thousands of miles per hour, it cannot adjust to the charge differential. So it is experiencing an increasing stress, and stress reaches a certain point, and then it begins to discharge electrically.
Thunderbolts of the gods, are these charges, are they like lightning bolts? I mean, are they hitting comets at this incredible surge?
In the near vacuum of space, what you get glow discharge phenomena. And right at the nucleus of the comet, you see, or in the close approaches that have been made by certain spacecraft, you see little bright spots here and there which have been unexplained. They, in my opinion, are the spots where an electric arc is actually eating away the surface and creating the jets.
And just hitting it.
They're actually easing it. It's a bit like an arc welding machine, if you like, and the material is being drawn from the comet nucleus into space by the electric arc.
Anyone can check out the Deep Impact site. This was in early July of 2005, and here a copper projectile was fired right into the nucleus of that comet, Comet Tempel 1, and it had a camera aboard, and as that camera approached the surface, you saw of increasing size these splotches of white. They were just whiteouts in the images. And this is really quite inexplicable, but that's what you would get with arcing going on the surface. And those splotches tended to be on the margins of cliffs, which is where, in electrical terms, you would expect the eating away of the surface to occur. So this has gotten almost no attention. But for a cosmic electrician, these pictures are the closest thing to a smoking gun of the electrical arcing on the surface of comets.
Will we ever be able to harness this field for either propulsion or energy?
That's a very difficult question because the energy is so diffuse. You almost need something like the size of a star to collect energy.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that our ingenuity can't extend that far sometime in the future.
Wallace, what does this tell you about the universe, the mere fact that this exists?
Well, it tells me that science made one colossal mistake back at the beginning of the 20th century when it decided to ignore electricity, because up until the end of the 19th century, the Scientific American, Nature Journal, the science journals of the day ran many articles by scientists who said the consensus is that the sun is an electrical body and that comets are electrical bodies. But at the beginning of the 20th century, all of that was dumped unceremoniously. And when you think about it, it's the strangest thing to consider that electricity, which we find so useful in so many ways, is completely ignored by nature in the universe. So once you accept the idea that electricity is operating in the universe, everything becomes much simpler, and in fact, this is usually an indication that the science you're doing is on the right track, because about the 1920s, up to that point, things had become much more simple. The number of particles that were in existence at that time and were known were very simple. Our view of the universe was much simpler, but then after that time, science seems to have lost its way, and it actually revels in complexity now. You've only got to read the popular science journals to see the kind of science fiction nonsense
that's
published.
And David, what does this mean to us if science truly begins to understand this and begins to report on it more?
Wow.
What does that mean to us?
Let me just say, and we can get back to this at any point, that the signs are there that windows and the doors are opening to electricity in space. Very often it's more like a back door that you see the mainstream of science beginning to acknowledge the presence of electric fields and puzzle over the enigmas that they raise. But, George, that's the most fundamental point that we want to register with public imagination, and that is a vision of a universe that is connected electrically. And that means at the intergalactic level and down through stars and star formations and down to planets and on our own planet Earth, life itself. And there is a connectivity within the physical world that tended to be denied by the evolution of science in the 20th century. Electricity will restore that, but it also has a profound message for the evolution of Earth and the rise of civilization. Events that occurred in the ancient sky are the most powerful witnesses of all to the electric force. And this is the basis of the convergence that occurred between Walt Thornhill and myself. I had spent my life reconstructing these extraordinary formations seen in the ancient sky. And it was Wal Thornhill who spent 30 days in my office in late 96, early 97, and showed me beyond any reasonable doubt that what I had constructed were electric discharge configurations.
All right, let's talk about that relationship when we come back. David, the fact that we have this force in the universe, this electronic force, is this like, you know, the ability for all of us to do what we do? You know, consciousness allows us to communicate with each other, this intuitiveness, this power that we have within the universe. Is this part of it? Does this electricity help contribute to this ability?
You know what, George? I think Wall may be the best one to answer this. I can just say that from my own reading in recent years, I've been very impressed with the amount of attention being given to subtle energies, these having a strong electrical nuance to them. Subtle energies within the human organism and the relationship to communication between cells and subtle forms of communication or paranormal communication between human beings and the way in which animals and human beings are able to connect with the electromagnetic field of the Earth. I mean, this is a very large field that is opening up, and I suspect we're going to learn a lot more in coming years than we know today. But I know as well that Wall has very specific ideas about the relationship of electricity to life itself.
Okay.
The electricity of life is a subject of a forthcoming book on our part.
Give us your thoughts, Wallace.
Well, George, the electric universe tries to simplify things, and I think, as I said before, that's the way to go for the future. And in doing so, I came across the work of a chap in New York who'd independently worked his way through physics. He's a mathematician by training. And he'd come to the conclusion that all subatomic particles, all the bits that go to make up an atom, are actually made of smaller bits. And those smaller bits are charged particles, both positive and negative. With that very simple model, he was able to show how you could explain gravity in terms of the electrical nature of matter. And it also showed how biological molecules, for instance, could actually resonate with one another and transfer information. And then that led to the work of the cellular biologist, Bruce Lipton.
Right.
Who has shown that the intelligence of the cell lies at the cell wall, not in the nucleus. The nucleus and the DNA is more like a toolkit, but the real intelligence lies where you would expect it, where it interfaces with the outside world. So the cells of the body are actually in communication with chemical signals in the bloodstream, but also they appear to be connected to signals from outside the body, which gives the idea of an extended entity. Each of us actually extends beyond the body, and it raises all sorts of interesting and philosophical issues, but it also helps us to understand the things that are being discovered in the field of extrasensory perception, the way animals seem to be able to communicate without speech or any other visible means.
It's almost like a radio between each other or a wireless phone.
The interesting thing is that this means of communication operates at the subatomic level, and it's the same system that planets and stars and galaxies use to communicate the positions of the objects within them. Because if you think about it, our solar system, unless all of the planets and the sun know where each other is instantaneously, then the whole thing becomes incoherent and will fall apart in a very short period of time. And the same goes for galaxies. So these beautiful spiral galaxies we see in deep space are actually held there by the same force that allows biological systems to communicate with one another. So this is a really integrating picture that the electric universe brings to the whole subject.
Do you think, Wallace, it's intelligent?
My personal view is that the universe learns, and it learns from us, from what we do. So what we do does matter. We're not sitting on an isolated rock spinning around an insignificant star to no purpose. And I think that provides us with a new picture of our place in the universe, which is both much more hopeful than present cosmology allows, and also gives us a purpose, it seems to me. Now, if the universe is capable of learning, and I don't quite know how it does that, then it is capable of reproducing an enormous amount of information at any point in the universe that it is required. So I think this is why I expect we will find life in the universe wherever there is an opportunity for it to take root, because the information is already in the universe, which will allow it to be born in that circumstance.
What if, Wallace, the universe is alive? Maybe not like we biologically think being alive might be, but what if it is alive?
Well, as an interconnected entity, you could say that it is a living thing, because it seems to organize, which is something that dead things don't. Dead things decay and fall to pieces. But the universe appears to be able to organize systems of galaxies, planets, living creatures, and so on, which implies to me an intelligence.
David, you've looked at the origins of ancient beliefs and symbolic traditions for most of your life.
Yes.
In the ancient times, did they know about this electric universe, these thunderbolts of the gods?
Great question. I don't think so in any sense that we would use, or by any definition we would use, but they definitely knew it in one sense. They observed it in a much more explicit way than we observe the electric universe today from such a distance. They saw the electric universe up close and personal, because they were the witnesses to stupendous electric discharging going on in the heavens. Now, this is a whole story that is so radically separate from the conventional view of planetary history. You sort of do have to start at the beginning. But my conclusion, after many years of comparing the themes from one culture to another and working only with the points of agreement between the different cultures, I found that by that methodology, it was possible to establish a reliable reconstruction as to what was seen. And what was seen were planets extremely close to the Earth, as extraordinary as that might appear to us.
And how close do you think?
Well, as close as the moon, and when you put Mars up there and Venus up there and Saturn up there, some of these as close as the moon.
Fully formed?
Yes.
Okay.
And of huge size. So this was a heaven-spanning congregation of planets in the most curious, the most extraordinary alignment with the Earth. None of this is believable when it is stated simply. But when people have had a chance to actually consider the systematic evidence that is available to us, and to see that this is simply working with the points of agreement between the different cultures, it becomes very convincing to folks. And I had the benefit of an inspiration from Emmanuel Velikovsky. It is my belief that the systematic evaluation of this historical evidence in the next few years will completely redeem Velikovsky.
Really? Because he was scoffed at. They laughed at him.
Absolutely so. And the best critics of Velikovsky today are the people in our circle. And they will tell you, George, that Velikovsky was wrong on many points. But what establishes Velikovsky as one of the great pioneers of the 20th century is the fundamental claims that he presented in his book Worlds in Collision in 1950 that are substantiated by massive additional research following the publication of that book. Very little of this has come into the public domain adequately, but it is headed in that direction. Amazing things are happening right now. I mean, at least six or seven people in our circle who have no appreciable record of publication in peer-reviewed journals are now appearing in a peer-reviewed journal, perhaps the most distinguished journal in its field, which is the Transactions on Plasma Science. And this includes Wal Thornhill and Professor Don Scott and plasma physicist C.J. Ransom and others that are an intimate part of our circle. So what I'm saying is that there is a historical reconstruction based on solid historical evidence, and it has met up with plasma science. And what is going on now is just extraordinary. There's an investigation involving dozens of professional and amateur researchers into rock art. And this was provoked originally by my communications to them. And it is demonstrating, even as we speak, that around the world, human beings carved onto stone images of these huge electrical formations in the sky, and global positioning, and very careful observation of the lines of sight.
Like the aurora?
Pardon me?
Like the aurora?
Well, Tony Perrat, who is the spearhead of this particular study from Los Alamos lab, he calls it an intense aurora.
Mm-hmm.
And he received his original inspiration in this study from communication from me. And it has taken over his life for 7 years. And there is a supercomputer running these images that has already demonstrated from different vantage points on the Earth that people were recording these extraordinary formations in the sky. The beauty of this is, he has no interest in Velikovsky. He has no interest in planetary catastrophe. If we are incorrect in our reconstruction of that planetary configuration, it will be Perrat's group that shows we're incorrect. But I could not be more confident. And there are many, many reasons for that. There's much to come into the public domain in the coming years. But this is an extraordinary time for us. That's what I'm saying. We did not dream 10 years ago that the kind of progress that has been made would be made. And this the material that is being investigated, is being brought together now, is definitive according to those who are looking at it. It is definitive. And Wal Thornhill has a major article in the very issue of Transactions on Plasma Science that I mentioned relating to stellar formation and supernovae. And it is a groundbreaking work. And it's getting a lot of attention from people now.
Velikovsky, of course, always believed that Venus was a captured comet.
Yes.
And is that part of his theory also that you
It is so much a part of theory. It is why you cannot escape Velikovsky. And there's just something so paradoxical about the situation right now. I'm working on a monograph with a fellow from Iowa, F. Cochran, editor of Eon, a Journal of Myth and Science. And it's called The Great Comet, Venus. It may take a year or two for this to get out.
That's amazing.
Lots on our plate.
I mean, they laughed at Velikovsky, David.
Exactly,
they put him
so
down.
George, they laughed at him, and for reasons you can understand. How could a planet be a comet?
Yeah.
Escape velocity from an Earth-sized planet or a Venus-sized planet, they're very close, would be about 25,000 miles per hour. So they said, that's excluding any possibility that a planet could become a comet. But once you entertain the electric universe and you see that electric discharging is the source of comet activity or comet displays, it's a completely different ballgame. And Velikovsky had the insight not only to examine the historical evidence and see that every major culture on Earth was pointing to the comet Venus, but he realized that science to deal with this historical evidence must come to reckon with electromagnetic forces. That's what made Velikovsky's genius. And we have so many points in which we would not accept Velikovsky's reconstruction in detail. But anyone who was such a visionary as to discern in the ancient record the role of this comet Venus must be acknowledged. And I see this as a major front opening up in the next year or two, a real confrontation with science, as we bring 30 to 40 years of rigorous examination of the historical evidence. We bring it to the scientific mainstream and ask them to challenge the conclusion that Venus did appear in the sky as the great comet.
If he was wrong on some things but right on a lot, why? Why didn't he get it all right?
Well, that's just not possible, I would say, George. But I mean, and he probably, if he were here, he would say, well, I did get it all right.
Exactly.
But the fact is, he was writing in 1950, and the pioneers never get everything right.
How did he come up with these theories?
Well, he was really pioneering a systematic comparative approach. The point is this. When different cultures in different parts of the world, using different symbols, different words, when they are defining the same phenomenon in the sky, in this case it was the planet Venus appearing as a serpent, a long-haired star, a torch of the sky, a feathered serpent or streaming feathers, a bearded star, and so on. These are the hieroglyphs of the comet in the ancient world.
Right, all similar.
Yeah, different words, different symbols. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just that a strange myth got dispersed around the world. They were using a variety of comet hieroglyphs and attaching those to Venus. And that's only the beginning, because once you really delve deeply into these stories, you see, well, this is the same phenomenon.
It's incredible. Now, if I recall, didn't Velikovsky say this captured comet occurred 6,000 years ago?
No, actually, he was speaking of an event that he dated around 1500 BC.
Okay.
And he connected it to the Hebrew Exodus, and there is a scenario that plays
the great
out
flood.
In Rose and Collision that I did not accept, and I didn't accept it because I was considering material that he had not accessed. And I was the first within the Velikovsky circles to say, now hold on, folks. This reconstruction by Velikovsky must be evaluated very carefully, and I feel that there are major mistakes in dating have been made. It's like themes of the great comet Venus in Worlds in Collision that he dates to 1500 BC. I was finding in the pyramid texts dated to 2600 BC. So that was just a fundamental issue that had to be addressed. Now, since then, everyone who's joined in this investigation has agreed that Velikovsky didn't get the specifics of that reconstruction correct, but that he nailed the comet Venus is the heart of the matter.
And Wallace, are you on the Velikovsky bandwagon here?
Well, he was the one who inspired me to
consider
the electrical nature of the solar system, and that was my interest.
So you're right there with him.
Oh, yes. So he threw down the gauntlet to astronomers, and no one dared pick it up. Rather than do that, they just vilified him.
Did anybody do any investigating of Nikola Tesla and his thoughts of the electrical universe as well?
I think Nikola Tesla, it was another kind of intuitive genius in his approach to electricity and the electrification of the Earth and so on. The problem is to get hold of sufficient hard evidence from his work to be able to say exactly what he achieved. Some of the things he seems to have done almost intuitively without explaining how he got there. So there's a lot of work to be done, I think, in re-examining the experiments he performed and looking at it from the electric universe point of view to see if where the common elements are.
Well, fascinating. We're going to take this break, but we're going to come back with another hour of discussion with both of you, and then the third hour, actually, of the program with you. We'll take phone calls from so many people who already want to talk with both you, David, and you, Wallace, as well. Their website is thunderbolts.info, and also holoscience.com. Both of those websites are linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. We're talking about their work, Thunderbolts of the Gods, and also the Electric Universe. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with David Talbot and Wallace Thornhill on Coast to Coast AM. David, what was once thought then of just a void in the universe between objects is not the case anymore, is it?
That's it exactly, George. We always grew up with the idea of a disconnected universe. These were just objects separated by immense distances of empty space. And now we know that space is filled with charged particles. That's really the definition of a plasma, presence of charged particles. And we know that there are magnetic fields that are stretching across vast intergalactic distances. And these magnetic fields exhibit then or reveal themselves to us as filaments, filamentary threads across huge distances in space are the witnesses to magnetic fields and the electric currents that create magnetic fields. So this is a connected universe, and now we have the opportunity to view this universe across the whole electromagnetic spectrum, and we are seeing highly energetic activity in space now. That's the subject of the Electric Universe, which we just published a few months ago. And the message of that book is that a revolution now is coming in which the scientific community must come to grips with the electric force in the cosmos.
David, and I'm going to also ask you, Wallace, you know, 2012 is not too far away. It's the end date of the Mayan calendar, of which so many people are theorizing so many different things. I happen to believe it could be some kind of solar event or some kind of universal event. The Mayans, for some reason, knew something. Might this be tied into the electric universe?
You know, George, you're on an exotic subject there in which I really do not have a basis for any conclusion at all, except this. And this is just a cautionary note because I don't know what other people are working with evidentially. But when it comes to calendars, I always want to register a caution with folks because most calendars were formulated in order to anticipate the recurrence of doomsday. Now, you see this in the Aztec and the Maya calendars continuously, like the Aztec 52-year cycle. That's really part of a systematic ritual anticipation of the end of the world. And so after 52 years, yes, they would run out into the streets and celebrate the renewal in life because they would look up at Venus and see that it was business as usual up there. Now, when the zeros on our calendar lined up in 2000, mm-hmm. that was preceded by a great deal of anxiety. And that's the same doomsday anxiety. Every calendar on Earth in ancient times really had this purpose of enabling astronomers and astronomer priests to see what was around the bend, but they were never accurate. The systems turn out to be arbitrary. So I can't tell you that there's nothing to the 2012 concerns of people, and I see things coming to me that actually look quite interesting, but with respect to 2012, I'd have to be one of the skeptics because I have never observed anyone anticipating catastrophe on a large scale.
How about you, Wallace? Do you look into the Mayan calendar end date?
No. In fact, I agree with David. pardon me. I think the interesting point is that we still are subject to the fears of the ancients. It's as if we've been imprinted somehow, like baby birds that freeze at the shadow of a hawk overhead. And I think that part of the fallout of the electric universe model is an understanding of our history, which will allow us to deal with these, what I would call, irrational beliefs from the past. So, and then a more irrational approach to both the way we live our lives and the way we deal with our planet. So that's my take on it.
Go ahead.
There is just an observation that is really kind of crying out now for recognition, and that is doomsday anxiety itself is so pervasive, and its components are so common from one culture to another.
And it's always been around, doomsday fear.
Exactly, and in the end, we must ask the completely rational question, where did this content of this fear come from? I mean, this is a fear of the end of the world. This is a fear of devastating catastrophe. Now, why is it, George, that when a little wisp of gas comes into view as a comet, the world was thrown into terror? It is because that little wisp of gas was a reminder of the great comet that presided over the end of the world mythologically. Devastating, world-altering, heaven-altering catastrophe, the most terrifying event in human history. So doomsday anxiety deserves to be analyzed and brought into the light of day. That will alone do the most to free us from the irrational levels of that anxiety.
Well, is there a fear that we're going to get hit by a comet one day? I mean, we've talked about the asteroids. We're trying to track them. But I don't hear a lot of people talking about us getting zapped by a comet.
Well, asteroids and comets are actually both fairly popular in scientific literature now, and this has actually become part of sort of a funding direction that theoretical science has taken, the search for potentially Earth-threatening asteroids. It is now a top item on the agenda for public funding in planetary science. And we would bring a little bit of a different perspective to this, George. It's not that we exclude the possibilities or exclude this concern or dismiss it, but the nature of the cometary catastrophe in the past was just overwhelming, and it was not anything like what they talk about in their descriptions of an asteroid hitting the Earth. This was a blazing, fierce, heaven-spanning phenomenon in the sky. What was the angry goddess of the world's great tradition? She's raging across the sky,
yes,
setting everything aflame. And she is associated with the planet Venus. The planet Venus was identified as the mother of life and also as the terrible goddess who, in her anger, nearly destroyed the world. And this was not a rock coming in and hitting the Earth. And in electrical terms, Wall will have to address this, but in electrical terms, there is reason to doubt that an incoming rock would survive the electric field of the Earth. And Wall, maybe you would like to just address that for a moment.
Yeah, sure.
But
first, I'd like to say that the search for a near-Earth object is another manifestation of the doomsday fear,
mm-hmm,
and it's played upon it. Yes, when you have an object highly charged like a comet coming towards the Earth, before it strikes the Earth, there will be an electrical discharge between the two bodies, and that discharge will usually be of sufficient magnitude to destroy the incoming object so that you would end up with a shower of sand and stuff like that. However, the electrical discharge between the two bodies can cause a significant damage on Earth. I think the Tunguska event in Siberia is an example where the object never actually hit the Earth.
Right.
Electrical discharge phenomena at the surface of the Earth, which was witnessed, of course.
And obliterated hundreds of thousands of acres.
That's right. Yes. So, and there was also the famous Chicago fires, where that whole area of the U.S. was lit up by strange fires and falls of sand and such like. And this occurred at the time of the disappearance of Biela's comet. So the traditional picture of what I call the pie-in-the-face model of asteroid impact where you see this object striking the Earth and great gouts of water from the ocean shooting into the towards space and so on, is completely wrong. There's not a sign of a lightning discharge anywhere in that picture, which makes it wrong, because the ancients said that the close approach of the celestial bodies was also a time of the celestial thunderbolt.
Indeed, and so that's the nature of the thunderbolts of the gods. And something just occurs to me as we're speaking here, George, and this is actually another door that is opening. There's a great fascination on the part of mainstream scientists today with the possibility that there is a thread of ancient mythology relating directly to cometary catastrophe, and they barely touch the myths. But what will happen, because they are giving that first hint of credence to ancient testimony, but they are going to be in for one devil of a surprise the moment they begin to take ancient testimony seriously, because they will right now be very selective in looking for testimony that supports an abstract physical hypothesis. A rock came in and hit here and created these results, and look, here are these stories that seem to support that. But once they begin to treat with any seriousness the phenomenon of human memory in ancient times and all the devices that were used anciently to record events, they are going to find that there is this vast reservoir, a library of records relating to the great comet and the terror that was unleashed amongst humanity and the ways in which civilizations on Earth responded to that sense of doom or threat ritually. And this, every ritual that was part of that magical response by the ancient cultures is evidence for us. It's telling us something about the nature of the event. And it's not going to look anything like what they're writing books on today.
David, we were talking last hour about how the planets were so closely aligned some time ago, and what a view that would be from good old planet Earth. I mean, Mars must have been huge. One of our regular guests, Richard Hoagland, he has theorized that he believes that there was another planet which orbited Mars, and there was an internal explosion there, and it's probably the main reason Mars might have lost whatever atmosphere it had at the time.
Yes.
What do you think of that?
Well, there is something enchanting in the general concept of the exploding planet or moon. Now, we are very closely aligned to Tom Van Flandern, the astronomer,
yes,
on this particular
point. Right, and Richard's close with him on that, too.
He's one of the pioneers of the exploding planet hypothesis. And there is an overlap in our interpretations of asteroids and small rocks and comets and so on in the solar system. And I do believe that Tom Van Flandern himself says that comets are not icy bodies, but largely just rocks on different orbits, generally on different orbits than asteroids, but the same constituent material. And all of us are saying that asteroids and comets and meteorites are substantially the remains of explosions in the solar system. That's either an exploding moon or material torn from a planet by electric discharge.
But not a planet that didn't form, which so many other scientists believe the asteroid belt could be.
Yeah, that's, to me, that's just stretching credulity completely. Now, Wall was the one who really convinced me that electrical discharge, removal of surface material from Mars and from moons of Jupiter and Saturn, is the primary source of the residual material we see roaming the asteroid belts and other regions of the solar system.
Do we know, David, if we were to accumulate all the known asteroids in the asteroid belt and put them together like you would a snowball, how big would it be?
You know what, George, I've heard the answer to that question from a dependable authority, and I'm not remembering what that answer was. Do you have an answer to that, Wall?
No, I don't offhand. I seem to recall it was a fairly small body, though.
A smaller body. Okay.
Yes.
Maybe then it could have been a moon of another planet.
If you followed Tom Van Flanden's line of reasoning, that's true. However, Tom had no really plausible explanation for why a planet should explode. The electrical model deals with this as a natural consequence of the things that were witnessed by the ancients. And the ancients also talked about the thunderbolts being associated with falls of rock from the sky.
Exactly.
So the two are tied together by the ancients, and I would believe their testimony first and foremost.
Well, there was an old One Step Beyond show of an old Western town, and rocks would fall from the sky. And, you know, they thought it was something, you know, very demonic or very
weird.
Well,
the ancients, George, the ancient chroniclers, poets, historians, and philosophers identified meteorites as coming from the planet Mars.
Hmm.
Now, on the planet Mars, there is one immense chasm. It's called the Valles Marineris. It was Ralph Jurgens, the engineer with whom I was closely associated in the 70s, who said that huge trench was carved by an electric arc in a planetary exchange, a planetary encounter. And I held that possibility in my mind as I was working with the historical investigation, and I began to notice these images of a warrior hero figure, a cosmic figure, wielder of the cosmic thunderbolt and so on, who I called the scar-faced figure. Now, in the end, I realized that the mythical images of the great scarred warrior, he has this gash across his forehead or his cheek or his thigh, And in more than one account, that scar is created by a thunderbolt. And when Wall visited me in 1997, I asked him if he could imagine the Valles Marineris, as Jurgens had postulated, actually being carved out by an electric discharge. And Wall pulled out his slides, and what he showed me satisfied me that there is actually compelling physical evidence that that was indeed carved by an electric arc. So there is a convergence here of the mythological image of the scarred warrior hero, the scar-faced motif, where the scar is created by a thunderbolt, and the actual physical evidence. Now, if in close encounters with Mars, material from that great chasm, which would swallow hundreds of Grand Canyons, if that material was catapulted into space along with a great deal of dust,
yeah,
we would have a very direct and simple explanation for the number of meteorites that they're now identifying as coming from Mars chemically, and the falls of red dust on the Earth. But you have to keep in mind, when they identify a meteorite from Mars, they're doing that on the basis of an atmospheric signature in soil.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
The thunderbolt that cut out the Valles Marineris would have excavated 1,000 times more material that would not have that signature because it would be down in the bedrock and so on.
What planet did that arc come from, David?
I'm quite confident it was from Venus. There was this violent exchange going on between Venus and Mars in ancient times.
Had Venus already been captured by that point?
Not captured in the sense that it was in its present orbit. No,
no. Okay.
This was a planetary configuration that provoked the great myths of world mythology.
Let's talk about that when we come back. That's an incredible story. Tell us when you think that might have occurred. I'll be back in a moment with David Talbot, Wallace Thornhill. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with them. Then that'll be it. I'll be back. David, let's pick up and talk about Venus, the break goddess, and then you were right in the middle of something pretty interesting there.
Yes, okay.
It is a violent, violent history that the ancients talked about. So here's the question. Were they witnesses to this event?
Boy, they sure were.
All right, what would it look like? Kind of, if we were on the planet then, tell us what we would be
Venus
seeing.
What look like?
Coming in.
The paradox here is that to describe the appearance of Venus does require you to see also other planets with which it was engaged. And, in fact, it's one of the greatest difficulties we have in communication, George, is to make this clear in words only. I can tell you that this coming year, what was seen in the sky is going to be presented in sufficient detail up on Google Video, that it will make this communications challenge much, much easier for us.
Okay.
But if you can imagine the sphere of the planet Venus with streamers radiating out from it as electrical discharge filaments, and at the same time that planet was engaged electrically with the planet Mars in various ways, at one time that there is a spiraling streamer that rushes out from the planet Mars to connect with Venus.
God.
So there was a dance going on in the sky. This was, in fact, the sidelock of the warrior hero. There is a reason for the kinds of images
mm-hmm.
that we see in antiquity.
Okay.
Why does the warrior hero figure so consistently find identification with the planet Mars? That's a huge mystery globally. And why does he wear a sidelock that is identified as the Mother Goddess? Now, if you go back to the first formulations of cosmic imagery in ancient Egypt, there are very few images that are more clearly recognizable than the sidelock of the warrior hero figure Horus that is called Hinsektet. Now, Hinsektet was the mother goddess Isis. So there is a history of this spiraling sidelock, which turns out to be the history of the cosmic serpent. And this can be reconstructed from Egypt to Mesopotamia to China to the Americas. It's a complex history, but ultimately it can be reduced to very simple glimpses visually. A huge sphere in the sky, the planet Mars, very close to the Earth, with material spiraling off of Mars.
And how many millions of miles away do you think from Earth?
I don't know if I would count that distance in millions. It was huge. It was taking, in its closest approach, it was taking up, let's just say, 20 degrees in the sky. The moon takes up a half a degree today.
Oh, my God.
We're talking about this stupendous...
I mean, it was like blocking...
...over pressing in on the Earth.
It blocked 20% of the sky, you're saying, basically.
Yeah. Let's just say, in its closer approach, it took up 20 degrees of arc.
All right. And if it was illuminated by the sun...
Yeah,
we didn't have nighttime on this planet then.
Well, there is a lot of evidence that the clear distinction between night and day as we experience today was not experienced by our early ancestors. But this, again, it's a complicated picture when you're just capturing or catching glimpses from a verbal description. Way back in 1996, Ben Gedlow, a Canadian filmmaker, did a 90-minute documentary called Remembering the End of the World, which was the story of this reconstruction, oversimplified substantially, but it does visually, that documentary, Remembering the End of the World, does visually capture glimpses of this close congregation of planets and what was occurring between them. The remarkable thing here is that I reconstructed all of that not knowing what a plasma is, not knowing anything about the electric universe. That was in 1996. It was the next year that Wall arrived and said, Dave, what you've reconstructed are electrical discharge configurations. And he was completely convincing. And then the world just changed because I didn't have a basis for a discussion with a scientist until Wall arrived. Then I had a basis for talking with scientists. Look, these are the images that we're seeing, and look, here are the formations taken by plasma discharge. That's how I ended up affecting the life's work of the plasma scientist Tony Perrat. He saw the formations that I had reconstructed. He saw the rock art images that I had conveyed to him, and he said, well, now, wait a minute. I've spent much of my life looking at plasma discharge in the laboratory. That's what this is. And that's changed the direction of his own life's work. Every time I mention Tony Perrette, I have to remind people he is not a Velikovskian. He is a traditional scientist. He's part of the scientific mainstream. He's doing his own work on this. He is going to let the computer determine what people were recording around the world. He's not going to be affected by anything I might interpret. And this is where we are now. It's a huge opening for us, and it is coming into the public domain fast enough that I can just assure people, George, that within the next year or two, you're going to have definitive material available to you as to what was seen in the sky, how it was interpreted mythologically, were the planets involved in this, or was it just an intense electrical effects such as an aurora or that sort of thing.
Well, the title of Velikovsky's book, of course, Worlds in Collision, one would ascertain that these objects were colliding with each other constantly. Is that the case?
Well, actually more so in my own reconstruction than in Velikovsky's. There's some clarification that is necessary here, and I'm a little bit nervous about not bringing you all into this.
I was going to say, Dave, that one of the tests of a good theory is that you can make an outrageous predictions in advance of discovery. And I should say that on the basis of the reconstruction that Dave had done, I was the only person on planet Earth that predicted what would be found beneath the clouds of Saturn's moon Titan when that lander drifted down beneath the clouds and started taking photographs.
Really? Okay, well, the predictive ability is going to be the heart of all of this in the end, and it's the only final test of a theory is how well it can predict the data in hand and how well it can anticipate the data yet to be received. And we have had the most I'm going to have to let you take over.
You're so excited here, dude. Get some water there. We'll have you pick up water.
Yeah, I think that what Dave was leading up to was the Deep Impact mission, where as soon as it was agreed that the project would go ahead, and 4 years before the event, I predicted that there would be a flash before the main flash and that it would be far more energetic than anyone expected. Now, that is another example of an outlandish prediction. No one else even gave any thought to being two flashes, and yet it did happen, and the astronomers were amazed and had difficulty in explaining it away.
And the electric model also predicted that the surface of Temple would be very sharply sculpted. On the Thunderbolt site, we predicted the flat-floored valleys in the and the mesas and so on. Now, if a comet is just an icy body evaporating in the warmth of the sun, it's going to have a very smooth surface. But instead, in the close-up images of Temple, you saw an incredibly sharp relief. Wall Thornhill predicted that because of the electrical nature of that body and the incoming copper projectile, that the effect would be substantial enough, despite the fact that the comet was miles wide and the projectile is just an 800-pound copper object, that it would redistribute the jets of the comet. And that is exactly what happened. And in just gravitational or kinetic impact terms, it's inconceivable that that would happen. But electrically, it was a logical prediction, and it was correct. No one else in science today, George, enjoyed any real success in anticipating these extraordinary outcomes of the Deep Impact mission.
Are you both saying, though, that let's say for some horrible reason, good old planet Earth was leaving its orbit and was rushing at 22,000 some miles an hour. Would it turn into a comet? Could it?
Yes.
Yes.
My God.
If it was moving through the radial electric field of the sun, it would become a comet. And that's exactly why Venus became a comet. And it is evident that in some form or another, the planet Saturn, with which we were intimately joined for a period, developed a cometary sheath, and that we were actually inside that cometary sheath. Now, I mean, that's just too extraordinary for words, but there's evidence for this. Number one, the planet Saturn was this towering form in the sky. Saturn is mythologically the archaic sun god, the primeval mm-hmm. sun god before the present sun, and the attributes of that mythical figure are very well defined. It is the stationary sun, the central sun, and it is the sun ruling in the sky as the first in the line of kings. There's meaning to all of these things, but it has to be carefully drawn out. But why would a little speck in the sky today be identified by the world's first astronomers as the archaic sun god? The Babylonian, Assyrian, magical, astrological texts say of Shamash, the sun god. Everyone recognizes that he is sure. the sun god. They say Shamash is the planet Saturn. Even the names Helios and Sol, the most familiar names of the sun to us today, were archaically the names of Saturn. This is completely enigmatic. But they drew pictures of these formations in the sky, and you can see exactly what Saturn looked like and the relationship to Venus and the relationship to Mars in this primeval configuration that dominated human imagination around the world. And they were drawing pictures of these forms in the sky, and they were building towering monuments to these forms in the sky, and recording myths and in their storytelling, recounting what occurred in the lives of these bodies. The story is incredibly coherent from one culture to another. The moment you look past the surface contradictions and you keep your eyes fixed on the points of agreement, because every culture was very self-serving in the way it told stories and accumulating details that completely contradicted the stories of other cultures, but they were working with an inherited tradition that is unified, and you expose that unified tradition by just staying with the points of agreement. That's a completely integral substructure of human memory. It's very reliable, and that's what I believe we will, within the next 2 years, present a completely convincing argument that humanity experienced things that have never even entered the minds of scientists today.
Could these catastrophes occur again and take us out, wipe us out?
This is always a possibility. And Wal, what's your perspective on a recurrence of a doomsday event?
Well, basically, it was the capture of a brown dwarf star, which we call Saturn now. Pardon me, I've got a frog too.
Sure.
The same kind of thing could happen again. I mean, if it's happened once in the past, it could happen again. And that would be the thing to look out for. But we would have plenty of warning because the electrical interactions of the sun and a brown dwarf star, as they both, their electrical environments clashed, would be quite spectacular.
Would we, when you talk about this warning, would things happen on this planet? Would we lose, would the power grids go out and things like that?
Yes, there would be some fluctuations. It would depend on the size of the incoming star. If it was a brown dwarf like Saturn, the effect on the sun would be almost unnoticeable, I think. But the effect on the brown dwarf would be considerable, to the extent that it would form the most stupendous comet we've ever seen in the sky.
Is there anything out there now, Wallace, that could be deemed a possible threat to us?
Not that I know of. Now that we have very good infrared telescopes scanning the skies, it seems to me that we would have a good advance warning of a brown dwarf, but we would have to be looking towards the solar apex, in other words, the direction the sun is traveling, and also where we've come from to look for such an interloper. It wouldn't come in from in the plane of the planets.
David, are you familiar at all with the work of Zechariah Sitchin?
I am. Okay. I got to know him a little bit back in 97. He spoke at the same conference that Wall attended when he spent that time in my office in 97. And I found him to be a very affable fellow, and I did find some points of common interest with him. One was the historic memory of a doomsday event.
Exactly. And let's not talk about the possibilities of the extraterrestrial visitation, but let's talk about his theory that there's another planet in the solar system that's on a 3,600-year elliptical orbit.
Yes.
Is that possible?
I think it is possible, but in terms of historical evidence, I just believe that you can be much more precise, that what occurred in ancient times can be reconstructed down to very fine details. And it requires a certain methodology, as I was saying, and it requires you to be open to whatever the myths, the historical memories are saying, no matter how unusual. As long as you are staying with the archetypes, these are the universal memories, you are on very reliable ground. But it's still, you have to connect the pieces, because every archetype, every universal theme is inseparably connected to every other. The important thing to keep in mind here is that there was a myth-making epoch. There was a phase of human history that provoked all of the stories. After that period ended, there was never a new archetype that entered human history. In other words, this was human imagination just exploding in response to these extraordinary events in the sky, and the only tools that humanity had were symbolic, and they were working with different symbols pointing to the same things. So there is a coherent substructure of human memory that can be reconstructed, and you name a theme of myth, George, and name another theme of myth that you're familiar with, and I can tell you exactly how they related to each other. There are no isolated themes of world mythology. So the point here is that it isn't necessary to take just a little thread of myths and try to build a hypothesis on that. What we have is a vast library that enables us to reconstruct the ancient experience down to extraordinary levels of detail. It's here that I would depart from Zechariah Sitchin, and this is quite apart from the extraterrestrial issues.
Right. Well, that's fascinating, though. And so the big question is it could possibly happen again, and we might have some warning. You know, they say that dinosaurs were killed by an asteroid. Now they're beginning to think maybe it was volcanic action that took them in. How do we know it wasn't some kind of arcing problem that created that?
I think we can almost guarantee that it was.
All right, let's talk about that when we come back. And then, I've always believed that there's a purpose for everything. Why is the universe so laden with electrical forces? We'll be back and take your calls. Wallace, what do you think did in then the dinosaurs? What happened?
Well, George, one of the strange things about the saga of discovery of dinosaurs is that in the early days they realized that some of them were so large that the only way they would survive in present-day gravity is to be waders and to use water to give them buoyancy. That seems to have been forgotten at some stage, and now we have these creatures gambling around the countryside, some of them at high speed, and yet weighing many, you know, tens of tons, maybe 100 tons in some cases.
Sure.
And it's been pointed out by a friend of ours, Ted Holden, that if you just do the normal calculations of muscle strength versus gravity, you would find that the dinosaurs could not have lifted themselves off the ground without breaking, practically every bone in their body, and they would have had to have been able to do in effect, the deadlift of an enormous weight. So it seems that for the dinosaurs to have existed on Earth, the Earth's gravity must have been much less, something like a third of what it is today. And, of course, this is complete anathema to those who believe that they understand gravity and what the mass of an object is. Now, the Electric Universe comes with a new view of this, which shows that Newton's law of gravity actually has more variables staring at the staring at us than anyone has been aware of in the past. And one of those things is that the mass of a planet can change depending on the amount of electric charge that it has. And so the Earth, in its earlier environment, before it became entangled with the present-day Sun, obviously had an electrical environment which was so different that the gravity on Earth was of that order, about a third of what it is now.
Is that why the creatures were as big as they were?
Yes, yes. Everything.
Even insects. Right. Everything was huge. They just found an insect that's 8 feet long, the fossil of.
Yep.
Well, there's a message.
The atmosphere was thicker, too, which made it easier for those creatures to fly.
Sure.
Yes. I was just going to say there's a message for us in that, George, and that is don't believe in coincidence up to the level of stretching credulity so far. How did it happen that in a particular epoch of planetary evolution, the surface of the Earth was taken over by gigantic life forms? And since that time, nothing comparable has occurred. Well, what has changed? Is it irrational to ask if the gravity of the Earth has changed?
Mm-hmm.
And there is so much evidence that that is exactly what happened.
Edward Leeds Skolnin. Ever hear of his name, David?
Repeat that name one more time.
Edward Leeds Skolnin, Coral Castle.
Oh, okay. Yes, okay.
He knew...
Within our group, we've had various discussions as to what that all might mean.
I think he might have been onto what you two have been talking about, and the ability to use resonance and electrical charges. I think he understood magnetism better than most.
I think that it is such an interesting question. I've never found an argument on any side that was completely convincing to me, but it's just one of those mysteries where you have to be open to extraordinary possibilities. And of course, the world is filled with enigmas that are just crying out for open-minded exploration. And maybe that is one, George.
Let's go to the phones now. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Welcome to the show.
George, I can't remember your guest names for the life of me, but my question is, I guess I could say it's fairly simple. My general understanding of the fusion model of the sun is that from helium, hydrogen, and sequentially heavier elements were all formed in the sun, and they were ejected out, and when the Earth was formed, they came to the Earth and formed the Earth. Now, how would that, the formation of the elements we have on the planet, fit within your electrical model?
All right, who wants that, you, David, or you, Wallace?
I think I should take that. The electrical model has all of the elements being generated in the electrical discharge that we call the photosphere of the sun. And the heavy elements, of course, will tend to sink into the sun, the body of the sun. And we also know that the spectrum from the photosphere shows 68, I think, of the 98 elements. Their spectrum appears there, and there's a bit of a question as to why that should be so. If hydrogen should be the lightest element floating to the top and being involved in producing the spectrum. in the electrical model, you have a more biological view of what happens where stars are formed in a plasma pinch, and in the process of settling into normal existence following that dramatic event, they may give birth, so to speak. To achieve electrical stability, the simplest way is to eject part of your core and to increase the surface area, which is subject to the electrical discharge that forms a star. Now, in the case of a star like the Sun, it could give birth to something, say, like Jupiter or Saturn. And I think this is a normal arrangement. In fact, in plasma laboratories, experiments have been performed which show that you would expect a number of stars to be formed at the same time in a string, And when the discharge fades, they will scatter like buckshot, but they will all still have the same rotational axis. And this is the kind of thing that is discovered near the sun, that most of the stars nearby have the rotational axis pointing the same way as the sun. This isn't explained by any accretion theory. Mm. So also, once you've got gas giants, they in turn can suffer an electrical outburst, which gives birth to their rocky moons and planets like the Earth and Mars. So it's a kind of almost biological view of the birth of planets, quite distinct from the gravitational theory, which has never been shown successfully how to work. In fact, I was at a seminar just a few months ago where an expert on the subject said, we need a different theory for every planet in the solar system. And that obviously is just not on.
Hey, David, the biblical flood, for example, caused by the comet?
Well, you may know, George, that over the years, well, over the centuries, people have speculated on the relationship between an incoming comet and the worldwide accounts of a great deluge. This is one of those themes of myth that I found, much to my surprise, I was departing completely from the usual interpretation. And a lot of this just comes down to what was meant by the mythological treatments of creation. And because there is a created world, and then that world is devastated. And the evidence I was following was just taking me in such a different direction. I'm even looking over my shoulder as I just say this. But I concluded that we totally misunderstood the creation legend. That if you let the myth be explained by the earliest accounts, it was the story of the way the gods formed their dwelling in the sky. It takes you right to that planetary configuration. The creation myths are always depicting a central luminary of the sky, an outpouring of luminous material as his visible speech or thought or dream, this material gathering into a sacred enclosure that is called the world. Now, this world comes crashing down. This world is the great wheel turning in the sky, the so-called world wheel of the gods. And its particulars can be enumerated in great detail. But there is an event that is the crashing of that world wheel. Because that wheel in the heavens was so closely associated with Saturn, its collapse is inseparable from the mythic death or exile of the primeval sun god. This is where the deluge myth originated. It didn't even have anything to do with our planet down here.
Huh.
That's how radical this is.
Well,
that
huge.
Takes a lot of argument to satisfy someone that this is, in fact, the origin of the deluge. It's the overwhelming of the primeval world, the land of the gods, by fire and flood. And it was told around the world. The details are most clear in the earliest accounts, and that is the doomsday event when the world wheel, held by the universal sovereign, identified astronomically as Saturn, collapsed, and the entire heavens were thrown into chaos. That's the deluge. It's not really separable from the rain of fire and gravel, for example, which is the Norse account of Ragnarok, and just an endless variation on that theme by the different cultures, because it was the cosmic city. It was the cosmic temple. It was the celestial kingdom, the place par excellence in the sky. It always meets the same fate.
Okay, let's go back to the calls. First time caller line, you're up with us. Hi there.
Hey, this is Jeff from Sacramento.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks. Hey, my question, I was wondering, if wormholes in space, if those were at all connected with electricity, and if so, how exactly were they? Were they? Have they always been there? Were they formed? I was a little confused on that.
Hmm.
Okay.
Who wants that? Who understands that?
Well, I think this is one of the science fiction notions that has been introduced, particularly by Einstein's rather quaint view of gravity. Once you establish that gravity is a property of the body and not something of space, then the idea of wormholes goes the way of the flat Earth and other theories like it. And space is just space. It's three-dimensional. There are no extra dimensions that we can detect. There is just, and it's linear. It's not warped. The idea of warping space requires another dimension. It has nothing to do with time, because if gravity operates at a speed far in excess of the speed of light, then Einstein's theories have to be discarded. And that makes life much simpler. And once again, as I said, any theory that makes life simpler is more likely to be an approach to the truth. So what you've asked is actually a good question, because it throws a spotlight on the kind of mathematical nonsense which actually derailed science back about 1920 and then for the rest of the 20th century. I only hope that this kind of nonsense doesn't persist for much longer, because it's diverting an awful lot of talent and resources and money looking for things that don't exist.
Wallace, let me ask you this, because you were touching on it. I've always believed that things are here, whatever is going on, has a purpose. Things happen for a reason. Things have purpose. What's the purpose of the vastness of the universe loaded, teeming with all these electrical forces?
This is one of those ultimate questions,
mm-hmm.
like where did it all start?
Exactly.
And unfortunately, I think the best we can do is to acknowledge our ignorance. We, at present, the electric universe is providing the tools to begin to ask sensible questions about the universe. And these larger questions are really for the future, because you begin to realize when you accept the electric universe model that the universe we see is actually much smaller than we've been told. It's not expanding. It's evolving, but in a biological sense. And we really don't understand how this came about or where it's heading. So these are the big questions for the future.
Next up, east of the Rockies, your turn. Hi there.
Hello, this is Mike from Augusta, Georgia.
Yeah, Mike, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just had a thought about the disappearance of the dinosaurs. Y'all had mentioned that the Earth had, at one time had more daylight than it does now.
Mm-hmm.
Y'all had mentioned that the Earth had more daylight at one time during the dinosaurs period. And I was just wondering if maybe the dinosaurs died out because of lack of light. You know, they're cold-blooded animals and they need more heat, being something massive. If that was the reason they might have disappeared.
Who wants the dinosaur question?
Well, I think, once again, the environment changed so drastically from our once being the satellite of a brown dwarf star to that of a main sequence star, and also orbiting much further away from the sun than we did from Saturn, means that everything changed. The kind of light we received, the amount of light. As Dave said, there was a time when there was no means of timekeeping, which would suggest that there was no night. Also, the lush vegetation that those animals required seems to suggest that there would have been a lot of red light involved, because red light is involved in photosynthesis. So everything would have been different. The color of the light, the amount of light, the lack of night, and so on.
And gravity.
And gravity, yeah, in particular. And when that all fell apart catastrophically, there was nothing left for the dinosaurs of their original environment. So any one of those things would have been enough to wipe them out, but combined, it made sure that none of them survived.
Well, it is amazing that your theories echo, as we've talked about all night, Emmanuel Velikovsky's, when they laughed at him. Do they laugh at you two anymore?
Continuously. No, it's not quite that bad. I think both Wall and I experienced a continuous dismissal if you go back a few decades. But the extraordinary thing that is happening now is by the hundreds, people are coming into our circle. And this includes people who are very well-trained in the different scientific disciplines and just the events of this past year have been a tremendous breakthrough. And I just envision this expanding this coming year into a completely different picture for all of us. I've heard Wall in intimate discussion with people of great accreditation, and he is simply superb when it comes to the science of the electric universe.
I wonder if this electric universe, David, will allow us to time travel one day.
I'm sorry, I'm a fan of Doctor Who, but unfortunately, it's all fiction.
Not going to happen, Wallace, huh?
No, once you have a means of signaling throughout the universe, which is almost infinite in speed, then time travel is impossible. Time travel, the idea of it came about because Einstein said that the speed of light was the fastest that you could transfer information. But since planets and stars and galaxies and so on know where each other are almost instantly, it shows that he was wrong. So we cannot travel in time because there is a universal clock ticking somewhere, and we're all dancing to that beat.
All right, well, we're going to come right back with final questions with our two guests, David Talbot and Wallace Thornhill. And again, both their websites linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We're talking about their work, really the work of two incredible stories and books, The Electric Universe and Thunderbolts of the Gods. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment again with your final questions on Coast to Coast AM. David, do you believe comets are seen as coming disasters, or is that superstition?
Well, I think it is entirely superstition, George, except that the superstition is based on a real event.
Yes.
So it's not just something made out of nothing. And incidentally, I was just realizing here that I hadn't mentioned that we've put up our Thunderbolts of the Gods video on Google. So anybody
can watch
that for free. Thunderbolts of the Gods,
yep.
Plural. And it's gotten excellent reviews from people. About 90% of the people viewing it have given it a 5-star rating. And it has, for us, become the best introduction that we can offer to people for no charge. And it's a compressed, very clear summary with glimpses of the ancient images as well. Essentially, it's an introduction to the electric universe with a few glimpses of the way the ancient sky looked.
Very good. Let's go back to calls. This is our final segment. Let us go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. The West, we'll go to you first. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Yeah, good. Go ahead.
I want to lead into something before I ask my question, but I have pretty much came to the conclusion that I disagree, in the sense that I believe there are many dimensions and that the only way extraterrestrials could possibly move through our particular space is to use dimension travel to do so, and that it's totally unacceptable they would travel through our space, probably because there are a lot of dimensions and they probably come from them. And as well, I don't necessarily follow where somebody would assume there are no dimensions, for the very fact that if that was to be the case, that there were no dimensions in the universe, to me that would be taking a very narrow profile. However, I want to ask you if you have any conclusions that may lead to the reason why spontaneous combustion may or may not be related to the electrical fields you were talking about.
All right.
That's for you, Wall.
Yeah. Watching a show just the other week on spontaneous combustion, and they explained it quite satisfactorily, I thought, in terms of normal combustion under abnormal circumstances. It's a long time since I looked at that problem, and it would require going over a lot of reports, so I can't really give you a good answer on that one, but I think eventually it will be found that there is an explanation in terms of slow combustion in a constricted atmosphere.
Why is it so controversial that, you know, the theories are with comets that they could be icy dirt balls, you know, dirty snowballs, iron, rock? Why the controversy? Why not just say they could be all of the above?
It wouldn't fit, George, for them to be all of the above, for the reason that the standard model does not entertain electric discharge activity across cosmic distances. And so that standard model is dependent upon heating from the sun, and that requires then the presence of volatiles or ices, and as a comet approaches the sun, then the evaporation creates the cometary display. In electrical terms, that display could begin way out, farther than Jupiter's orbit, and it could be quite spectacular because everything is determined by the ellipticity. That's how elongated is the orbit and what is the speed with which it is moving through the electric field of the sun across what distances. And this is why the bodies that come in on as long period orbits are the ones that always put on the spectacular displays. This was comet Hale-Bopp, for example, and Halley's is a pretty long period comet, and it puts on a pretty nice display. Comets that are not moving on such elliptical orbits, that are just a little bit more elliptical than, say, an asteroid, they put on very minimal displays. This is a quite consistent fact that is very consistent with the electrical interpretation, whereas everything that is occurring to comets, particularly since we really began observing them closely, has come as a surprise to science. You look at the history of comet science today, and I don't believe that you will find any significant predictions that were fulfilled.
Mm. I think also, Dave, the standard view of comets is based on a myth. And the myth is the formation of the solar system from a condensing nebula.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said earlier, no one has been able to show how that would work. But they still have to maintain that myth. So if comets are not what they think they are, then that myth is destroyed, and they have no story to tell us about how the planets were formed. And, of course, this is not something to be contemplated.
There's been a confession by people deeply involved in comet science, typified by a statement of one principal investigator of a major NASA project directly to me. He said in that conversation, "I do not know what a comet is anymore." That was very telling. And you see in the responses to these new discoveries that one astronomer after another is confessing that, well, something it really does need to be reconsidered at a fundamental level. But we're not seeing the really fundamental reconsideration that is necessary. It only will take the acknowledgement of electricity in space, and then the whole picture will be re-envisioned.
David, are there any graphic pictures of comets on cave walls or anything like that?
Absolutely so. They're all over the place, but you have to compare closely the relationship between the image and the story. If you see a serpent on a wall, let's just say an undulating serpent or a spiraling serpent, you are not going to think comet. It's not directing your attention to the way comets look today. But in point of fact, the spiraling and undulating serpent is the most common ancient image of the comet. And it's not just a serpent. It is a long-haired serpent, a feathered serpent, a fire-breathing or fiery-countenanced serpent. And it is a bearded serpent. I mean, every feature is a combination of the hieroglyphs of the comet in antiquity. And when has a serpent, a snake, ever displayed feathers or long flowing hair or flame or any of that? It's clearly an integral symbol. So, yes, the serpents are drawn on stone all around the world, and the entered mythology is one of the dominant themes of the myths. There is a complete story of the serpent that can be told, and it will connect you up directly with the great comet Venus. In ancient Egypt, for example, the most popular serpent image is of the Uraeus serpent. You see it on the headdress of the pharaohs and so on. I mean, it's just on every page of the ancient ritual text. That was the mother goddess. And it was a fire-spitting serpent, and it nearly destroyed the world.
Let's go east. Attack. All right, east of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
George.
Yes, sir.
It's an honor to speak with you. All I can say is, you know what, I was a big Art Bell listener. When you took over, I tell you what, I adjusted. I just got to say you're doing a fabulous job with your...
Different styles. Go ahead.
I basically am listening to your two guests. And I think what really pushed me to call is, first of all, when they said about the Einstein theory, that I believe the one gentleman said, now if I'm misquoting, you know, please straighten me out, but he said Einstein didn't know what he's talking about, you know, speed of light and time travel. And basically that kind of pushed me to call.
All right.
And what blows me away is I'm listening, and you know what? I really truly believe this. When I hear people talking about how the gentleman said that they believe the planet Earth is a prison planet, it astounds me for all the years that I've lived that when you look at this world, when you look at just the human body and the way we're designed, and then all the shows that I've ever seen, I'm kind of a big Star Trekky person,
yeah,
and they show all these other creatures from other galaxies and whatever. We are the most sophisticated design compared to all these other beings. So when they compare us to these serpent forms or even the grays or whatever, to me, they're designs of their makeup, three fingers, two big eyeballs. You know, it clearly shows that whoever designed, and we know who designed us, the humans, that the person that clearly designed us took a lot of love and a lot of time to design us as well as they did. And I really, truly believe that there's a reason why we're not allowed to use 100% of our minds, because in some sense, I really believe we're little gods, and if we were allowed to use 100% of our brains, you know, technically what man has done now with the development of nuclear bombs and weaponry, you know, you really have to think, if we were allowed to use the complete mass of our minds, what would happen? And I think there's a reason why we've been limited, why we can't. So I guess basically my comment is why I called is, you know, it's pretty hard for other people to look at serpents, even though they've been mentioned throughout the years, you know, as being better than we are. Technically, I really think from a biblical aspect is that the serpent, and as we know, and I learned this off of Art Bell's show one time back in the 90s, that the serpent was taken as being a being of deception to deceive us.
Sure.
And so when I look at the fact that, you know, yes, the serpent is used all over the world and it spits fire and hair, I clearly am a little insulted that people would think that the serpent, the snake or lizards, when you look at these creatures, they're ugly.
You gotta
be honest. I really truly believe they're jealous of us, and I'll take it from a Bible text.
All right, let's get a comment if we can from you, David, on this before the clock gets us.
Yes, okay. Well, thank you for that. And I'm not sure whether we can really communicate on this, but just to be crystal clear on one thing, let me just establish one point for clarity's sake, sir. I am not suggesting any intelligence whatsoever to the mythic serpent. That is just a mythological interpretation by human beings
at
a rather barbaric level of interpretation. They saw spectacular plasma formations in the sky, and they interpreted these formations because of the lifelike quality.
They look like serpents,
them as intelligent creatures. There's no intelligence involved in this, as far as I can tell. It's just a physical phenomenon that was very alive in the imagination of human beings.
And I'm enjoying the show, but you know what? I'm a big Carl Sagan follower into the science and everything, but when I sit down and honestly compare science and then the biblical aspect, you know, we have a beautiful universe. We have a beautiful planet. And the being that designed us, and I'll leave it at that, I already know who did it. I mean, they took a lot of love and a lot of intelligence to design us and create us the way it did. There were steps where we are at now. So basically, my comment is just what I had said, and I want to just say, George, you're doing a great job. I love your show, and I'm really enjoying the show.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate you being on the program. Well, thought-provoking nonetheless, David and Wallace.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, we're living in a situation today in which there's just a tremendous freedom for people to express interpretations of on very deep and mysterious questions. The cosmic serpent figure is, in fact, one of the most interesting images in the ancient world, and it has helped to provoke ideas about reptilian intelligences and so on. If people could realize that the ancient serpent images had nothing to do with intelligence at all, that it was a dream by human beings on Earth as they were witnessing the most extraordinary natural phenomena. So if I hear someone speak of today of, the reptilian extraterrestrial influence and this sort of thing, the first thing I would look for is some influence on their thinking by a misunderstanding of myth.
Okay, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Take it away.
Hi. I have a question for the man about the electric universe. I was curious what his viewpoint was about Nikola Tesla.
All right. We touched on that a little bit, Wallace, but you're the man.
And I was curious also, Nikola Tesla, I believe, had said that Einstein's theory would break down, but he had also voiced, I believe, that there would be possible time travel and movement of objects through the electric universe. So I was kind of curious about all that.
All right, go ahead. I'll let you summarize that again, Wallace.
Okay. I'm unaware of any comments of Tesla's about time travel, but he's in good company when he has reservations about Einstein's contribution to science. There were many, many scientists at the time who were highly skeptical, and there are a growing number today who are skeptical. So he was in good company there. I think once my work has been concentrating on the electric universe model and the big picture, I think at some point somebody has to, it may be me, it's probably somebody else, we'll have to go through Tesla's work and see the points of commonality and where one may shed more light on the other and from that point of view advance the frontiers of science.
David, we're wrapping up here. We've got a minute left. I'd like you to tell us about both your websites and where do you get Thunderbolts of the Gods?
Yes, indeed. Thunderbolts of the Gods and the Electric Universe can both be accessed through the thunderbolts.info website, and if you have a chance to see the Google video presentation of Thunderbolts of the Gods, which is, of course, at no charge, and you want to obtain a higher resolution version of that, it's packaged actually with the book Thunderbolts of the Gods. And Wall Thornhill's site, holoscience.com, has some of the most groundbreaking work on the electric universe that you could access anywhere.
Good job, both of you. Thank you so much. Go get some sleep, okay?
Thank you, sir.
All right.
Thanks for the opportunity, George.
Anytime. David Talbot, Wallace Thornhill. Wallace, of course, in Australia. David, not too far from where we are. Maybe a few thousand miles. That's not far. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaTessour, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.